Welcome, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. As the situation in Iraq threatens to descend into a regional war, the U.S. Will be sending up to 300 military advisors to help train Iraqi troops as the Islamic insurgents known as ISIS advance toward Baghdad. In a press conference yesterday, President Obama insisted U.S. troops will not fight in Iraq. On today's Media Roundtable, we're devoting the entire hour to the crisis in Iraq, its roots, implications for the future of the Middle East, and the debate over how the U.S. should respond. We'll be looking at the coverage of this issue and the coverage of the 8-year U.S. war in Iraq, the 2011 pullout, and its aftermath. We're asking a lot of questions this hour, including why all of the sudden are all of the pundits who wrongly argued for the U.S. to wage war with Iraq credibly greeted by media as they gun for yet another military intervention in Iraq. We're joined by Mark Seibel, who's the chief correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. Hi, Mark.
Hello, how are you doing?
We also are expecting Borzu Daragahi, who's a Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, and he'll be joining us from Cairo. And with me in studio is Aaron Glantz, who's an investigative reporter covering veterans and domestic military issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Hi, Aaron.
Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. So we always like to start with a shout-out to good journalism of the week. And why don't we start with you, Mark? What story do you want to tell us about?
Well, I'm actually going to tell you about two. One, because I think it highlights the difficulty of the situation we're in, and another, because I think it did a very good job of talking about who our rivals are in this current situation. The first one is a story the New York Times did Wednesday about the dispute within media organizations and with the U.S. government and others over what is the name of the organization that we are suddenly confronted with in Iraq. Now, McClatchy and other organizations have called it for months the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, or variant, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria. The other camp, which is led by the U.S. government, now AP and Reuters have both joined that camp, and they call it the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. People either call it ISIS or they call it ISIL. And it's an interesting problem because, of course, when we write stories and they go out to the many newspapers that publish them, the newspapers have to decide whether it's going to be ISIS, as McClatchy calls it, or ISIL, as the AP calls it. But I think it actually gets at an interesting argument or discussion point, which is, what do they call themselves, and which best reflects who the organization thinks it is? In Arabic, the word that we translate as Syria is Sham, which means basically Greater Damascus. But it includes an area that includes Jordan, Israel, Lebanon, certainly, and it would be something that a long time ago would have been referred to by English speakers as the Levant. The New York Times story, and they're in the ISIS camp, the New York Times story points out the Levant is a European concept, and it would never be used by this particular group to describe themselves because they would not use a European term.
And that's why your paper is choosing ISIS?
Well, we chose ISIS because the word is Sham, which begins with an S. And we noticed that in their English tweets, they referred to themselves as ISIS. And so we thought it was a fair transliteration of what they call themselves.
And let's go to Borzu. Borzu, what reporting did you see that you want to highlight this week? Do we have him? Borzu, do you mind starting again? We didn't hear your beginning.
Oh, sorry. I mean, I saw a lot of great stuff, especially from the Kurdistan region. Again, it's extraordinary. This little island of Kurdish culture is becoming prominent again. I don't remember any particular story, but just the depth and breadth of the coverage about Kurdistan, about its reemergence as a power in Iraq and in the region, its ambitions for the city of Kirkuk, its finances, its mechanism. It's been really refreshing to see this area once again under the spotlight.
And how about you, Aaron?
Yeah, I would agree that it's been nice to see the coverage coming out of Kurdistan. And, of course, one of the reasons that we're seeing that is because so much of the country is unsafe and the Western media is basing itself out of Erbil these days because nobody is shooting at anyone else in that city. The most powerful thing I saw was actually a PBS NewsHour piece from Independent Television News. And there was nothing really spectacular about the piece itself except for the fact that you got to see these ISIS people in a convoy of American Humvees, which they had taken from the Iraqi army. Then you got to see them battling with the Kurds, you know, because there's this whole frontier fight now between this, you know, resistance or rebel or whatever group and the Kurdish nationalists in Kurdistan. And they, of course, have also received guns from us. And then there were shots of the Iraqi army, which, of course, we're also supporting. So it just kind of struck me for the first time that so many of the weapons in this fight on all sides can be traced ultimately back to American military involvement in the region. And even though nobody said it on the NewsHour, you know, that was the takeaway that I got.
And we're going to talk about those connections between the U.S. war invasion and what's happening right now, and some of the roots of the conflict that we're seeing right now. But I wonder, Borzu, if you could tell us, let's agree that we're going to call it ISIS for now. Who is ISIS? Who are ISIS? Do we have Borzu?
ISIS started out as an organization called Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Led at one point by the infamous Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, a Jordanian who was eventually killed in 2006 in a U.S. Attack, a U.S. airstrike. Once the Syria conflict started, the successors for this organization, al-Qaeda in Iraq, sort of rebranded themselves and took root in Syria, where they were among the most extreme of the groups and the most willing to inflict civilian casualties and the most welcoming to foreign jihadi fighters. Eventually, the gentleman by the nom de guerre Baghdadi took over this group, and he has he seems to be a man of vision. You know, many see him, many in the counterterrorism community see him as a sort of lucky Luciano of al-Qaeda, bringing sort of corporate techniques to the sort of organization of terror and militancy in this part of the world, using, for example, quantification mechanisms to keep track of how many attacks have been launched and how many fighters have been recruited. And, you know, eventually when it got sort of strong enough, when it saw an opening in Iraq, it launched this attack. It considers itself a transnational organization that encompasses not just Iraq and Syria, but also Lebanon, and, you know, the broader the term, the Sham, also refers to Palestine, Israel as well.
And so what's, you say he's a man of vision, what's the vision?
But, I mean, he's serious about, if you look at the way the group operates, for example, in northern Syria, they're very serious about establishing the institutions of statehood in the areas they control. They're really serious about, for example, setting up courthouses, setting up governance, setting up mechanisms for the distribution of aid even in the areas they control. And also they're dead set on imposing rules for the people who live in the areas under their control. This has got them into some trouble in Syria, where other rebel groups, they come up to them and say, hey, let's compromise on this. We don't agree with this. And the ISIS leadership will say, what are you talking about? We are the government. We are the Dola. We are the state. You can't argue or compromise with us. We're not just another rebel group. We are the state.
And the news coming out of Iraq is getting more alarming every day and complicated. What do you think has changed since the fall of Mosul to the ISIS forces? And I'm reading actually right now from ABC News that troops are surrounded and trapped in Iraq's key refinery at Baji.
Well, I think that they somewhat become bogged down, haven't they, in a certain respect? You know, they kind of won a lot of easy turf where, you know, sort of the Sunni heartland of Iraq, where you had a lot of sympathizers, where you had a lot of allied or temporarily allied insurgent groups that emerged from the woodworks and helped them take control. But they've not been able to get any closer in the past week toward Baghdad. And they've not made good on their promise to go after the shrine cities, Najaf and Karbala. They're, you know, sort of, it's kind of settled into a stalemate. And even in the case of Beji refinery, yes, the rebels make this claim, the government makes that claim. They haven't been able to pump any oil out of that refinery yet, which is critical for their needs. Right now, Mosul, the city of 2 million under their control, is suffering a terrible shortage of fuel and energy. And this must figure into their calculations that if there's any more deprivation, the people there could become unruly.
And let me bring Mark and Aaron into this conversation. Mark, in recent years here in the U.S., there hasn't been that much interest on the part of media organizations or the public to hear about what's happening in post-war Iraq. And we heard a lot toward the end of the war that Americans were suffering from war fatigue even before the pullout. Now reporters are rushing back into Iraq. What stands out for you about the coverage we're getting about Iraq today, now?
Several things. The first item, I think, and both of my colleagues have mentioned this, the fact that everyone first sent reporters to Erbil in Kurdistan, that struck me as very much recognizing what the situation is in Iraq now, which is the Kurdish areas are the only stable areas. And it was a place we could put somebody. One, they didn't need a visa to go there because the Kurds have always allowed Americans with American passports to just simply arrive at the airport and come into the country, which is something that Iraq proper does not do. And that we knew we could also have communications facilities, housing, and would not have to worry about a rapid descent into chaos. So that's one thing that the coverage immediately struck me, the fact that we all just immediately sent people to Erbil, to Kurdistan, as a place we were going to base. What's struck me since is that you realize what a knowledge gap exists within the United States about what's been going on in Iraq for the last 2 or 3 years. And how much of, I mean, I have a tremendous sense of deja vu as I look at stories and watch things unfold about things that happened, you know, 10 years ago. Suddenly I'm having to think again about Tal Afar and Bakuba, Diyala province, these places that I haven't thought about, Samarra, that I haven't thought about in a long time, and how they used to be the daily content of our newscasts. And our news stories, and then we thought, I think everybody thought, the war was essentially over, that we'd left it to the Iraqis would figure out a way to muddle through, though it's been clear since the early part of 2013 that ISIS was a real challenge for the Iraqi government. It had taken parts of Fallujah, another city we all know the name of, and held on to it for months, in spite of the attacks. ISIS was mentioned primarily in the context of Syria, and mm-hmm. that's the important thing, too, because, you know, what is ISIS's goal? ISIS's goal is the establishment of an Islamic caliphate that extends to the entire world. That's its goal. And so it's setting it up in Iraq and Syria, and it took advantage of the situation in Syria where the rebels had forced the government out of wide areas of northern Syria, but had not controlled the area. And ISIS just moved in and took it.
And, Mark, I imagine Aaron Glantz is also feeling that sense of deja vu, having covered this war early on and written your first book, I think, How America Lost Iraq.
Yeah, I would agree with Mark's sentiment. And also, I was just thinking, as he was talking, about the way in which those early days, I mean, even before Fallujah was a household word in 2004, in 2003, after we overthrew Saddam Hussein, how we, the American government, sowed the seeds for a lot of the things that we're seeing now. I remember being...
Like disbanding the military?
Well, like disbanding the military, but more importantly, the particular way in which we set up the coalition provisional authority, the U.S. government set up the Iraqi government before there was an election in 2005. I mean, there was a quota system in place. There was going to be so many Shia, so many Kurds, so many Sunni in the Iraqi government based on their proportion of the population. And we worked extensively with different exile groups that had been out of favor with the previous regime, that were coming back in, who were then going to represent their ethnic community in the government. And so at that point, you had a society which, of course, had previously been under the thumb of a brutal dictator and a Sunni-dominated state, but one that also included the other ethnic groups within this kind of a state dictatorship, to one where people were really encouraged to affiliate with their cleric. And then, of course, when we were unable to keep the electricity on, to establish a reasonable police force that people could call if there was a crime, these sorts of things. And people, this began to become even worse. People started to form militias and join militias that were affiliated with the different clerics or ethnic organizations at a rate that there hadn't been before. I mean, none of us, when we watch this debate and we see Prime Minister Maliki on television we see him on television and we hear him say, the commentators say, oh, well, he's just looking out for the Shia. We should not forget that when Saddam Hussein was president of Iraq, he was in exile in Iran running a political organization that wanted
That's
to
where
do,
Maliki was.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Exactly what he's doing right now. So none of this was a surprise. It's just kind of sad that it's turned out in the extremely depressing way that it has.
And I want to ask Borzu about that same sense of deja vu, but let me first give out the number, Borzu. If you want to join our conversation, we're spending the entire hour talking about the coverage of the crisis in Iraq and the recent assaults on cities by ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, which is what we've decided to call it. Where have you seen great coverage? What's missing? What do you want to know about what's behind this latest surge of violence in that country? 866-798-TALK is our toll-free number. It's 866-798-8255. Should we have been paying more attention before now? Our guests are saying this isn't surprising, but it's being portrayed as very much a surprise. 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. 8255. And if you've seen a piece of news that you want to highlight for us, you can also let us know at that number or send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. And Borzu, let's go to you about this whole sense of this isn't surprising. We should have seen this coming.
Well, I covered Iraq from 2002 to 2007. I pretty much lived in Baghdad from 2003 to 2007. So yes, for me, this is sort of familiar, but I want to sort of differ with one thing in terms of the conventional wisdom. I think there's a view that the heart of the problem in Iraq has been Maliki and his sectarianism and his incompetence, and I think that is all true. But I think one thing that is even I think in some ways an even more important factor is and that has driven the sort of sectarianism of Maliki and the Shia is the constant, nonstop attacks by insurgent groups against Shia civilians, which have never stopped. The bombings of markets, of civilian areas, and so on. The suicide bombings of funeral tents that we've seen that have been going on that don't get a lot of attention in the Western media. These have not stopped, and these are what has driven Maliki to some extent and what are putting pressure on him and from his community. And I also think that, what has happened in Iraq over the last couple of years, maybe it wasn't inevitable and it wasn't mostly a result of our failures in Iraq. I think that Iraq was a mess in 2011 when we left. And it was, you know, a very, very bad situation. But I think it was still manageable until the Syria crisis spilled over. And I think that was the sort of X factor, the variable that just pushed the country off the cliff. You know, people had warned that if we don't do anything about Syria, it's going to spill over. Well, this is a prime example of that. So I tend to think, and I agree with Lakhdar Brahimi, the former UN advisor to on Syria, that what's happening in Iraq is more a consequence of our failures in Syria than in Iraq.
And a lot of the proponents of the original Iraq war, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, William Kristol, all of them are coming out and blaming Obama's pullout of 2011 for the crisis right now and inaction on Syria.
I think it's really important what Borzu was saying about Syria. It's one of the depressing things about these recent developments is when Iraq was blowing up before, millions of Iraqi civilians ran away to the peace in Syria. And Syria was very much a safety valve. And in fact, when President Bush and President Obama would complain about Syria harboring terrorists in Iraq, Bashar Assad's comeback was, just imagine if I wasn't taking all these refugees, what a disaster we would have in the Middle East. And that was true. Now that Syria itself is in rebellion against his dictatorship and that this has been going on for long enough that the whole country is in crisis, all of these refugees ran back to Iraq. Well, now the war is in both places and there's no safe place for civilians, you know, in that region. I mean, people can go to Jordan. The Jordanian government, though, is not as welcoming as the Syrian government was. And the crisis is escalating by, you know, exponential degrees because it is in both countries. And it does make it a lot more difficult for any outside force like the United States to do anything useful.
Yeah. I'd like to jump in here.
Go ahead, Mark. Yeah, we just have about a minute before the break.
Okay, just a couple of quick points. First off, I think it's interesting to talk about the crisis spilling over into Iraq from Syria. It's actually an Iraqi crisis that went to Syria. And it's a key point, and we can discuss that in greater detail. And I think the other thing that this recalls for all of us is that you really need to think hard before you destabilize a stable society. That's what we did with Saddam Hussein. It's what we did with Bashar Assad. Those were stable societies that we decided to change.
And it is difficult. We decided to change Bashar al-Assad?
We sure did.
We promoted it.
We pushed it. We created Friends of Syria. We organized public relations campaigns to get
So we should have let Bashar just kill all those people who were protesting in the street week after week?
Well, I'm saying when you make that step and you don't know what you're going to put in place or how you're going to deal with it, you unleash forces you are not in control of.
And we haven't even talked about
the Turks wouldn't
Iran.
Have done anything.
Guys, I'm going to have to just stop you. We're going to continue right after a quick break. Borzu, can you stay with us a little longer?
Sure.
Great. Borzu Daragahi is a Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. He's joining us from Cairo. Aaron Glantz is an investigative reporter covering veterans and domestic military issues for the Center for Investigative Reporting. And Mark Seibel is the chief of correspondence for the McClatchy newspapers. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. We'll be right back.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard yet in today's discussion, or a question you'd like to ask you feel needs to be answered, please join our conversation by calling 866-798-8255, toll-free 866-798-TALK. You can send an email, if you prefer, to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment on the website, yourcallradio.org. Coming up in 30 minutes at 11 o'clock, State of the Reunion here on KALW San Francisco.
I'm Holly Kernan in for Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. That's also where you can listen to past shows and find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we'll talk about recent U.S. massacres and ask whether we are facing an epidemic of gun violence. How might society change if we treated gun violence as a public health issue? That's Monday when Rose Aguilar will be back. Today, we're talking about coverage of the crisis in Iraq and the recent assaults on cities by ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Where have you seen great coverage? What is missing? We'll have an open line in a minute and I'll give out the number. We're talking with Mark Seibel, who's chief of correspondence for McClatchy Newspapers, Borzu Daragahi, who's a Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times, and Aaron Glantz, who's an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. And before the break, I'm sorry I had to cut you off. I want to hear from both Mark and Borzu. Mark was talking about how the crisis really was an Iraqi crisis that spilled into Syria, and you were both arguing about the role that the U.S. has played in the Syrian crisis. So go ahead, Borzu, why don't you start us off?
Well, I think that, you know, we can overestimate how much influence we have over these things. You know, the people of Syria, the majority of them, rose up against Bashar al-Assad, who responded with ferocious, insane violence against civilians protesting in the street week after week. They eventually took up arms. They were students. They were pharmacists. They were lawyers. They were mechanics taking up arms against Bashar al-Assad. They were given support, maybe a little bit from the U.S., mostly from Turkey, Saudi Arabia, mostly from weapons that they stole from Bashar al-Assad himself. And they carved out a safe zone, and they said to the world, come and help us. And no one really went and helped them. And so in this safe zone, in this rebel-controlled area, is where ISIS, which is Al-Qaeda of Iraq, as Mark pointed out, is a former Iraqi militant organization, took root, expanded, and began fighting the rebels at some point. So, I don't know where we could have intervened to make sure that that wouldn't have happened. You know, I think that we have had very little influence in this region over the last few years. For example, right now there's a lot of talk about will the U.S. nudge out Maliki, like as if the U.S. had that kind of leverage anymore to nudge out Maliki, as if we had any kind of clout to tell the big Shia politicians in Iraq it's time to get rid of Maliki. Sometimes the U.S. is not the big, bad, all-powerful, omniscient power that many in the region and some in the U.S. believe it to be.
Go ahead, Mark.
Well, one of the things to keep in mind, and I think it's something that's important to think about Syria, about Iraq, about that region, it's something Obama talked about before he became president, and I always think of the David Petraeus confirmation hearing to become, I think it was to be commander in Iraq. And he, this is 2008, before the first presidential election that elected Obama. And Obama said, don't we have to learn to live with ambiguity? And I think it is a really important point about this region, which is we can't really impose our will. Not without a huge, huge commitment that I don't believe this country is able to make.
And some of the roots of the current conflict are in the U.S. trying to impose its will.
I mean, just in listening to Mark about the moral ambiguity and the limitations of American involvement, it's also true that things often backfire. And, you know, that's what I was saying at the outset of watching this program on TV, where there was this convoy of American Humvees going through Mosul, except for the occupants of these Humvees were members of ISIS. And then there were shots of the Iraqi army that we've been training, doing battle with them. And then also the Kurds, which we've also been supporting, also engaged in this fight. And these three factions, which have very disparate political views and are often at odds with each other, you know, all just as a result of our participation in this war over time, all having weaponry that we are the ultimate source of, whether or not we meant to give it to them. And I think that, you know, we just have to be really cognizant when we talk about sending military advisors or weapons or anything that, you know, these things can later on be used for other purposes. You know, they don't have to do what we want. Our power is limited, but, you know, folks are more than happy to take a gun and use it for their own purposes, which may or may not be what, you know, Senator McCain or President Obama have in mind.
And we've got a lot of callers on the line and emails to get to. Let's go to Claudia from El Sobrante. Hi, Claudia. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm contributing here because I have a friend who's Syrian, and we've had some discussions about what's going on in both Syria and Iraq, and I've also seen some postings by people, you know, who are coming from the same ideas. And I was just totally amazed when we were discussing Iraq that he saw U.S. takedown of Saddam Hussein not as replacing a military or replacing a dictatorship with a democratic government, but as replacing a Sunni with a Shia.
Hmm.
That was his first response. And this guy's, you know, been in the United States for 20 years. He's lived in Spain for 5 years. He's not, you know, like a villager or something. But that was his first response. And so I wonder, going back to the, you know, the scene of tearing down the Saddam Hussein's statue and everybody standing around cheering and we think we've got popular support, I'm wondering now if some enterprising reporter could find the people who were doing all the cheering and find out that they're actually Shia. Who were delighted to bring down a Sunni dictator, again, not for any political reason, but just because of the sectarian divisions. And the same thing with when he talks about Syria. He was talking about, you know, why the U.S. doesn't do anything? Why the U.S. doesn't do anything? Whether we could or not. I mean, possibly we could have withdrawn all support from Maliki when the government did not apportion power among all the different groups. You know, when that didn't happen, that might have been a time to threaten to withdraw immediately. Say, well, look, we can't support you because you don't represent the people of Syria and of Iraq anymore. But when he talks about Syria, the same thing. Why the U.S. didn't do anything? Why the U.S. didn't do anything? And he is having sympathy for organizations like Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Not that he's, you know, going to send the money or go over there and join them, but he's feeling desperate and saying, well, you know, if they didn't help us, these guys offer to help. And he's very torn up about it because he also loves the United States. So it's an interesting thing to watch.
It's very complicated.
He kept saying, that never happened before. We never before had Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Never, ever.
In Syria. Well, thank you very much for the call, Claudia. Let's go to Sarah in Felton. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to your call.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I've just noticed that no one's talking about the oil, and I wonder if that is actually the reason why we're going in there, America's going in there, or maybe with Halliburton's blessing.
Well, let me be clear. Yesterday, President Obama said we were not going in there. He was sending 300 military advisors to check out the situation and to help, but no troops would be on the ground in this fight. That's what he said.
Of course he didn't mention the oil. I just wondered what your specialists on the program have to say about it, because, of course, he didn't mention the oil. We all know that he's not going to mention the oil.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Sarah. Let's hear Borzu, Mark, Aaron, oil. Is that at the heart of this conflict?
Well, I think oil is very important. The FT has a story just today about how actually oil production and export has not been affected one barrel by this whole conflict. Because much of Iraq's oil resources right now are coming from the south of the country, which is right now very, very placid, very peaceful relative to the rest of the country where the conflict is going on. So for now, I think that, you know, it's a little bit overstating it to say that, you know, the U.S. is going there because of oil. I think that is one concern, not so much that we want to take control of Iraqi oil, but that if the conflict were to spread to that relatively placid area, that could affect world oil prices, not just for Americans or for Halliburton, but for everybody. And that would, you know, sort of trigger a new recession worldwide.
And go ahead, Aaron.
Oh, I do want to agree with Borzu that that, you know, this is not a conflict about oil in the way that the caller is suggesting, but it is a conflict about oil for some of the participants on the ground. For example, the Kurds have for you know, ever since this started, wanted to include Kirkuk, which is an oil-rich city in the north, which is ethnically divided, which is outside of the official Kurdistan region, in the Kurdistan region, so they could have control of that oil and then have an economic engine for their country if they decided to declare independence. And in Kirkuk right now, the facts on the ground are changing. Borzu and Mark mentioned earlier that there's a conflict right now in Beji, which is the major refinery city
in
northern Iraq.
And ABC News is reporting as we speak that Iraqi troops are battling for that, and they're surrounded, and it looks like ISIS is actually winning.
Yeah, so this is extremely important. Oil is an extremely important aspect in the domestic Iraqi calculation, even if it is not a primary driver in the American response.
Yeah, I just want to add one other thing, that ISIS is self-sustaining in part because it controls oil fields in Syria, and it would love to have control of that refinery, because the betting is that once it's in control of the refinery, it can bring it back online, and the government might even help them, because it produces 60% of the domestic supply of gasoline in a country that needs lots of gasoline and has to import 25% of what it uses. So that's an important strategic location, and ISIS can benefit by holding it. And they've used oil elsewhere as part of their financing. One of the things about ISIS is that it's not a little terrorist group that's dependent on people in Qatar or Saudi Arabia to give it money. It is a self-sufficient operating state, and that's one of its. And I just want to mention fracking. One of the reasons the U.S. has less concern about oil from Iraq, and U.S. oil companies have very low involvement in Iraq oil production, is because the fracking revolution in the United States has simply made Iraq not as important for us.
And you're listening to our Friday Media Roundtable on Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. I'm joined by Borzu Daragahi, who's Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. Mark Seibel is chief of correspondence for McClatchy Newspapers. And Aaron Glantz is an investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. We have a full bank of calls, and I want to get to more of them. Let's go to Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to Your Call.
Hi. Thank you so much. I was just wondering, why would they use the acronym ISIS? ISIS is an Egyptian goddess, one of the most powerful goddesses of ancient Egypt. They were considered that pagan, and it's a female goddess.
Anybody?
I don't think it's related.
In Arabic, they call themselves, many people call them Daesh, which is an acronym for the Arabic acronym, Dawla al-Islamiyya al-Araq wa Bilad al-Shams. It's, you know, that's what they call themselves. I think ISIS is just a translation. Some people call it ISIL, ISIL. And, you know, I don't know. It's a semantic issue. Who cares?
Greg writes in and says, as your guest from McClatchy pointed out, the current argument between McClatchy and AP Obama in what ISIS should be called, I think it's clear that the Obama administration wants to avoid referring to an acronym which includes Syria in its name because it links our policy in Iraq with our policy in Syria, which Obama would rather keep artificially separate, not in the least because we are supporting Sunni insurgents in Syria and fighting them in Iraq, which is insane. That's from Greg. Let's go to another caller. Let's go to Dory Stein from San Francisco. Hi, Dory.
Hey, Holly. I wanted to just bring up a story which I haven't heard in the debate at all, although I was turned on to it from what's called a Loeb Log, named after Jim Loeb. It's LOBELOG.com. It was an article yesterday written by Marsha Cohen. The headline reads, Israel, the silent stakeholder in northern Iraq. And it talks about how for decades, Israel's been arming and training Kurdish paramilitary forces, their elite anti-terror units, all of this in northern Iraq. And Seymour Hersh documented this like 10 years ago in The New Yorker, but he wasn't given much credibility at the time. Now it's proven to be true. And it's led by, apparently, a former Mossad chief, Danny Yatom, and Shlomi Mikhails, who is an Israeli-American entrepreneur. And Mother Jones, excuse me, has also written about it, talking about how the AIPAC spy scandal is related to Israeli involvement in Kurdistan, and also corruption through kickbacks. And anyhow, the bottom line is, if Iran turns out to be a major player in the solution of the current, you know, current situation in Iraq, Israel, you know, will be one of the biggest losers. And I don't know if your guests want to comment on it, but I thought it was an interesting story.
All right. Thanks for that, Dory. Does anybody want to comment on Israel's involvement in this? Mark?
Well, I have to say I'm not really certain precisely what it is. I will say this. Kurdistan is a very interesting region, and it is an oasis of stability in a very unstable situation. And I have heard it compared in terms of American involvement in Kurdistan and American interests in Israel. I've heard the two compared to one another. And it will be, it's a region to watch.
What about Iran, Borzu or Aaron? What is Iran's role in all of this, and are they going to be part of the solution?
I think Iran has a very prominent role. It has a influence with the various Shia factions. I think it might be exaggerated a little bit how much control Iran has over what's happening in Iraq. I think they're very, very disturbed about what is happening in Iraq right now. I don't think they're happy with it. They did not want the partitioning of the country. They do not want ISIS or Al-Qaeda or such a Sunni Islamist militant group on their borders. So I think that they're in panic mode to some extent, trying to figure out what to do, just as the U.S. is figuring out what to do. I don't think from a U.S. point of view they're going to be seen as helpful, anything that they're going to do.
And Ahmad Chalabi is back in the news in now all of this.
Oh, I missed that bit about Ahmad Chalabi. It's always great to hear that he is in the news. But
Another architect of the invasion.
I wanted to think a little bit more about both Israel and Iran. And I just wanted to say, I think it's a mistake to view what's going on as some kind of proxy fight. I mean, there's 25 million people who live in Iraq. There are outside factors involved. There are, you know, foreign jihadis fighting as part of the ISIS movement. Kurdistan does have its own independent relationships with the neighboring countries. But, you know, the Kurdish government in Iraq, it plays with Israel, it plays with Turkey, it plays with Iran, plays with countries like Turkey and Iran that are oppressing their own Kurds for its own benefit of, you know, Barzani and the PUK political movements and the other movements there to, you know, keep stability and strengthen their economy and move towards, you know, they hope, an independent Kurdistan someday in Iraq. And they, the Kurds, have been extremely quick to exchange friends, trade friends, betray friends, you know, over the years as benefits them in any particular moment.
And let's go to another caller. You're listening to Your Call. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Holly Krennan, and let's go to Jack in Los Altos. Hi, Jack.
Hi. Good morning. I was perplexed about the lack of coverage of our 2003 invasion, which destabilized much of Iraq. It's hard to believe that the Bush underlings wrapped themselves in the mantle of the American flag, seem oblivious to the chaos that we have caused in the Middle East, first favoring Saddam Hussein with chemical weapons, which he used against the Kurds and Iranians, then launching a shock and awe attack in Iraq, disbanding the Iraqi Ba'athist Party, Ba'athist Stabilizing Army, made up of Sunni and Shiites, and then hastily boasting mission accomplished, leaving a dangerous vacuum led by Shiite Prime Minister Maliki. And prior to our departure from Iraq, the U.S. employed death squads to create strife and social conflict using the El Salvador model to create a U.S.-sponsored civil war.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Jack's point. We mentioned it earlier in the show, but really making this linkage in media coverage between the U.S. occupation invasion of 2003 and what's happening now. You were there.
Yeah, I think that Jack is right and he's wrong. You know, he's right that a lot of seeds of this were sown when we overthrew Saddam and the particular way in which we, as Mark said, destabilized a stable country without thinking about the consequences, no matter how brutal that previous dictatorship was. But I think that he's wrong in thinking that, you know, a couple of years after the last American combat troops left the country, that the U.S. is the primary force in what's happening now. And I would agree with what Borzu said earlier, that we need to have a little bit of humility in the way that we approach what's happening there now, and know that we are not even, we're not just not the first most important player, we might not even be the third or fourth most important player.
But if the U.S. was responsible in destabilizing the region initially, what's our responsibility now, Mark?
Try not to break it again. I mean, that's, you know, I mean, I guess it was Colin Powell who used that, if you break it, you own it. Well, you know, you've broken it, and you may not be capable of putting the pieces together.
And Dick Cheney is calling for a new intervention.
Well, you know, this is one of the things, I think if there is anyone on the American political scene whose concepts of Iraq should be completely discredited, it's the former Vice President of the United States. And why organizations go to Dick Cheney for any sort of cogent observation about Iraq, I really don't understand that. There are plenty of people from the Bush era who are worth quoting, but it would not be one of the architects of what, looking at it 10 years later, can only be called a failed U.S. intervention.
And let me squeeze in one more caller and one more email. Slater writes in, the U.S. endlessly has to relearn at enormous cost the ancient lesson of imperial powers, see ancient Rome, that invading territory is easier than holding and controlling it. Now ISIS is having to face the same difficulty. Ultimately, they face the problem of huge areas, large populations, and a small force. Let's go to Pat in San Francisco. Hi, Pat. Welcome to your call. If you could be brief, we're running low on time here.
Yeah, I was just saying, you were talking about irony. When this whole thing started, I remember what happened 39 years ago in Southeast Asia with the fall of Vietnam.
So remember your history.
I was asking a lot of Iraq veteran friends, what do you think the 275 soldiers that Obama sent over are doing? And he said shredding the documents in the U.S. embassy so that when we have to completely abandon it, there's no secrets left. And, you know, there's no information behind that, and it's a joke. But it does indicate that, you know, I think there are probably there's probably a reasonable possibility that at some point we might be in that kind of ultimate Vietnam situation where we're out completely 100%.
Well, this is depressing. Can we talk about what President Obama suggested yesterday, that there could be a political solution here? What are the possibilities for resolving this? Let's start with you, Borzu.
Well, I think it's the key player, as I might have indicated earlier, in this whole political formation, government formation process, will be the major Shia parties. And today you had an interesting development. We just reported it on the FT.com website. Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani, the top Shia cleric, sort of gave a little bit of a nudge towards the political class and a little bit of a thumbs down to Maliki. Essentially saying that the next government needs to be an inclusive government of national unity, of national consensus, rather. And, you know, this is seen by many in Iraq as the top Shia cleric who is revered by middle class and lower middle class and wealthy Shia mostly, but also has a broad respect from all Shia in the country, essentially giving Maliki a nudge out. And that has much more influence than the U.S.
And how about you? Go ahead, Aaron. You want to talk about solutions here?
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, even if Borzu is right that Ayatollah Sistani wields enormous influence and is also respected by the other ethnic groups, unlike some other Ayatollahs, but at the same time, you know, the people in ISIS are, you know, many of them foreign jihadists, many of them extremely hardline. I mean, there's going to be more shooting in addition to whatever sure. political settlement happens.
Well, yeah, I think that's a very important thing to point out. There are facts on the ground, as they say, that can't be done away with by a new government structure in Baghdad. Now, maybe they can reach some sort of accommodation with themselves, but you still have to deal with an Islamist force with local Sunni allies that has seized effective control of an enormous part of Iraq.
And really quickly, Aaron, I know that a lot of the news coverage this week in the U.S. is about how veterans from this war are reacting to this new crisis. What are you hearing from veterans?
Well, I mean, I think that it's just an unpleasant reminder that the war isn't over, you know, and that, you know, people trying to turn the page and get on with their lives, just like, frankly, the rest of the country, except for, you know, if this is something that you experience personally, it's a little bit more of a wake-up call.
Well, thank you all for talking with us about this. We'll be watching the news as it develops. Borzu, are you going to be going to Iraq?
Monday, Baghdad.
Monday to Baghdad. Well, good luck. Be safe. And thank you all for joining us. We're going to put links to all of their work at yourcallradio.org. Borzu Daragahi is a Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. Mark Seibel is chief of correspondent for the McClatchy newspapers. And Aaron Glantz is an award-winning investigative reporter with the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's the author of How America Lost Iraq and The War Comes Home, Washington's Battle Against America's Veterans. Again, we'll put all of that information at yourcallradio.org. You can also post information there and post comments and continue this discussion as well. Thanks to everybody who emailed and called. I apologize that we couldn't get to all of you. I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. What do we know about the effects of gun ownership on public health, and what should we do about it? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation about gun violence as a public health issue. How many Americans are killed or injured by guns each year? How would the debate on gun violence change if we treated it as a public health crisis? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.